So I'm giving you this set of lectures during this week. So this in integrability in gauge gravity dualities. So Jaume last week introduced you to the EDS CFT duality, to relating a four-dimensional gauge theory, which is n equals 4 super Young Mills. And I review here its Lagrangian, couple of Feynman rules, what you need to know to understand today's lecture. And he also explained that this theory is dual to a 10-dimensional string theory, which turns out to be type 2B string theory in some curved space-time called ADS-Fine times S5. I will review a couple of those points throughout the lecture. So what is the main motivation for this week of lectures? So the idea is that we now know one of the most important objects, or one of the most important subjects in theoretical physics, is quantum field theories. In particular, quantum field theories in four dimensions, because we live in four dimensions. And so far, humans don't know how to solve four-dimensional field theories. That's a limitation. And we would like to solve one four-dimensional gauge theory. Our hope is that if we solve one four-dimensional gauge theory, we might be able to understand a lot, and maybe even then to generalize and to solve more four-dimensional gauge theories. This is more or less the same, like if you did not know how to solve the two-dimensionalizing model, the two-dimensionalizing model would be the simplest possible, which is just spins, classical spins on a two-dimensional lattice. This would be the simplest possible model to start understanding classical models on lattices. And that is the model that you should start by studying, understanding completely the full analytic solution of that model, and then you could start adding flavor to the model, adding degrees of freedom, etc. Yes?
How would you actually know what's the simplest?
Right. So what is the simplest model? Why is n equals 4 the simplest model? Well, that's the main purpose of this set of lectures, to show you that there are some remarkable structures hidden inside n equals 4 that you cannot see by looking at the Lagrangian of n equals 4, which actually make n equals 4 a solvable theory, at least to some extent. So another evidence for the simplicity of n equals 4 comes, for example, from the study of scattering amplitudes in this theory. It turns out that you sum hundreds and hundreds of Feynman diagrams, and at the end, the result is extremely simple, much simpler than the one that you would find in usual chromodynamics, whose Lagrangian a priori is much simpler. So what kind of properties this theory has? So it's a conformal field theory. So it's a field theory in four dimensions. It's conformal. It has lots of symmetries. So here is the Lagrangian. So is this Lagrangian familiar to everyone, probably, after this set of lectures? So there are the usual term in quantum electrodynamics, the usual F squared term. Out of two covariant derivatives, we make a field strength. Then we have a covariant derivative of a scalar. So this is the kinetic term for scalars. The number of scalars, this I, runs from 1 up to 6. There are 6 scalars, which in the original derivation is related to the number of dimensions in the brain. And then there is a potential for the scalars, a commutator of phi I, phi j square. So this introduces some quartic vertices, which are represented here for these scalars. There are some fermions, some 10-dimensional fermions, some 16-component fermions. And therefore, this looks at the first sight like the kind of field theory that you want to know how to study. It contains gluons, it's an unabelian gauge theory, it contains matter in the form of scalars and fermions. So certainly, this looks like a rich field theory. Now, it turns out to be conformal, so it's not the best field theory. We want to study QCD, which is not a conformal theory, which has other kind of properties. But the idea is that this would be the first toy model, as I said. There is lots of symmetry. For example, this index I can, of course, rotate this index I. It appears here phi I square, and there is a symmetry which rotates the scalar among themselves. This is an SO6 symmetry of the theory. There is also some symmetry, which is less familiar probably to you, that Jaume probably explained, which rotates fermions into scalars. And this is what's called supersymmetry. And all this symmetry, this rotation of the scalars among themselves, the translations in the plane, the Lorentz symmetry, the conformal group, the symmetry which rotates fermions into bosons, it combines into a symmetry group, which is called PSU2,2/4. We will hear more about it during the lectures. And it turns out that this symmetry group is so large and so constraining that it turns out to fix a lot of the dynamics of the theory. And therefore, it allows us to go very far away into solving it. And there is another remarkable property of this field theory, which is absolutely not obvious from this Lagrangian, which is this field theory is also described by a two-dimensional sigma model, which is a dual string theory, as Jomi explained. And this is, of course, a highly non-trivial property of this field theory, which is the one that it has a two-dimensional dual model, which we were able, or we think we were able, to identify rigorously. Of course, we believe that any non-abelian gauge theory will have some string dual because of the argument counting planar graphs that you saw. There is a genus expansion, and therefore you expect to have a string dual to any field theory. But in general, it could be a very complicated string dual, and you don't know how to identify it, and we believe that we did it in this case. But the ultimate goal is to solve this field theory in four dimensions, and as a bonus, we will have solved a theory of quantum gravity because of the ADS-CFT duality. Okay, so I want first to explain you where, how the techniques of exactly solvable models appear in the context of these four-dimensional gauge theories. And it will appear, this is a conformal field theory, so the simplest possible object that I want to compute in a conformal field theory is two-point functions of two operators, phi of x, phi of y, say, which we know that is only a function of the difference of the distances because of rotational symmetry. And we also know, Jomi, I saw in one of the tutorials that you were explained, that we know that if we apply a conformal transformation to the fields, we must get something like this shift, this dilatation to the power of the dimension of the field times the correlation function phi of x, phi of y. And this automatically implies that correlation functions in a conformal field theory are of the form 1 over x minus y to the power 2 delta. So our first goal in understanding of conformal field theory is to study the simplest possible object, which is two-point functions. Two-point functions are fixed by symmetry, by conformal symmetry, to take this form. So our goal, our first, very first goal, is to compute delta. So that's what we want to do. We want to compute this anomalous dimension. Okay. And we want to do it, we will always focus in a planar limit of n equals 4, which you understood that we only want to consider summing planar graphs. Okay, so what is this delta? So if you have, say, a scalar field, we know that the scalar field, if you have, for example, a scalar phi I of x, phi I of 0, this is proportional to 1 over x squared. This is just a propagator. This is just a propagator. Or in Fourier space, it's 1 over p squared in four dimensions. Now, therefore, the dimension, say, of a scalar is 1. The classical, when I just compute the propagator by doing weak contractions and by putting a propagator between two points. But now, I don't have just a propagator between two points. I can have also quantum corrections here. Plus. And by doing this, by introducing these quantum corrections, what happens is that this dimension, delta, is corrected. There is the classical dimension, which is just contraction by weak theorem, just contracting the fields, and you read the dimension from the action. Each field has dimension 1, and you just see how many fields you have to contract. In this case, 1 field, so you have dimension 1. If you have more fields, you have other dimension. And then you have an expansion in the coupling when you start introducing quantum corrections. At one loop, you have this. At two loops, you have this, etc. And this is what is called the anomalous dimension. That's what is the interesting part, not, the, of course, the free theory with contractions. How do we in practice compute this in perturbation theory? So what we find is the following. In perturbation theory, what we compute is we pick some operator which there might be several indices, so I parameterize them by A. And this zero means that the operator is bare, is not normalized, not renormalized. I just pick the field from the Lagrangian, and it's the bare field of the Lagrangian. And I compute the correlation function between this guy and some other guy, say, at x. And what I get when I do perturbation theory, I get 1 over x minus y to the 2 delta 0. This is just the weak contractions between the fields. And then when I start computing the corrections, I get 1 plus lambda. This is one loop. OK. And then typically, what I get is something like this. So let me put the factors correctly. I want minus. Then I have a divergence, which will be typically of this form. I have log of some cutoff of the theory. And it should be dimensionless. So this is multiplied by x minus y. So this is dimensionless. This is the coupling, because I'm at one loop. And there is a constant here, which I can call lambda 1. I parameterize it in this way, plus whatever I get at two loops. This is what I get in perturbation theory. I start making my loops, and I get some, this graph will be, some graphs will be proportional to log of the cutoff. And this is the result when I compute these bare fields. Now, this can be rewritten in the following way. 1 over x minus y to the bare dimension of the field times exponential, OK, not exponential, let me write it differently, times lambda square x minus y square, everything to the power minus 2 lambda delta 1. No, there is no 2 because I put the square here, plus et cetera. So you see that indeed, if you expand this in lambda, when lambda is 0, you get the 1, and then you get this term, and then dot, dot, dot. This is what you get. So what you get is this. When you do perturbation theory, you get something proportional to lambda, and there might be some log divergence, and you rewrite it in this way. And this is, of course, lambda to the power minus 2 lambda delta 1 times x minus y to the power 2 delta. This delta 1 combines with this delta 0 to give the delta. And this means that the operator renormalized, this is the renormalized operator, x, which I define to be lambda to the lambda delta 1 times the bare operator at point A, with some indices A, this operator here obeys this relation. So this renormalized operator, I pass this guy into that side, and then it obeys the, it got an anomalous dimension. So the renormalized operators, they have an anomalous dimension. So, and of course, it makes sense. You see, this OA, imagine it was a scalar. It had dimension 1. I multiply it by something which is cut off to the power lambda delta 1. So if this guy had dimension 1 because it was a scalar, a bare scalar, now, because I multiply it by something with dimensions, it no longer has dimension 1. Now it has some other dimension, which I can say what it is. It's the 1 plus this delta 1. And because now it has another dimension, I know that the correlation function must be at this form. But what I want to emphasize is that in practice, then, what I should do if I want to compute anomalous dimension of fields is renormalize them and see what is the multiplicative renormalization, what multiplies log lambda when I do one loop Feynman diagrams, and the coefficient of log lambda is the anomalous dimension. Okay, any questions so far? Is everyone following? OK, so this is an important relation between what I just explained, between the multiplicative renormalization of operators, the way they are renormalized, which is the coefficient of log lambda in the divergence of the one loop diagrams. It is directly related to the anomalous dimension of the operators. OK. Now, in practice, the story is not so simple. Because what happens is that in general, there are many operators O, 0, A with the same classical dimension, delta 0. For example, in n equals 4, I have the operator, I don't know, say for example, trace of phi I square, and for example, where there is a sum over I, and for example, trace of phi I phi j with some symbol like this, where this symbol means symmetrized and traceless. I symmetrize this quantity and make it traceless. For example, these two guys, they have the same classical dimension. Both of them are made out of two fields. So when I compute just the free weak contractions, I just have trace of phi I square. So this is a field which in the double N notation I can represent like this, right? There are two fields. And they are multiplied and there is a trace. So this is the index of the matrix. And they are contracted, so there is this other line at the very end, right? And when I make weak contractions, when I compute the at tree level, I just put here two propagators. So I just get 1 over absolute value of x squared, and there are two propagators squared. So just delta is equal to 2. And this is true both for this guy and for this guy. But in general, they could have different anomalous dimensions. This guy could have some anomalous dimension, and this guy could have some anomalous dimension. Or actually, it could be that none of them has a definite anomalous dimension, but only a linear combination of the two has a good anomalous dimension. And it could be that I need to sum both to get an operator with a good dimension. So let me be precise. So what do we do when we have this mixing, and how do we do in general? So, well, this is a problem. Okay, let me write here. So in general, the coefficient, so what, okay, in general, the coefficient of, and we will do an example explicitly to see how it goes, of log lambda is not just delta AB. Probably I was forgetting some delta AB here, yeah. So now, here I am in, there is an index A and B, and the operator should be the same. So normally there is a delta AB here. And implicitly, I was assuming that there was a delta AB there. But in general, what happens, is there color shock here? In general, is not delta AB, the coefficient, but instead, it's HAB. It's in general a matrix, HAB. When this is the case, when you get some divergence here, which is some HAB, the most generic case, and not delta AB, what happens is the following, is that you can diagonalize and fix a basis where H is diagonal. You rotate first and it becomes diagonal. And then you get the previous case. In other words, the eigenvalues of H, which I recall is the coefficient of log lambda, the eigenvalues are the anomalous dimensions. Very important. And the eigenvectors are the operators with definite anomalous dimension. Okay? So what we should do is renormalize the operators so that the correlation functions between operators become finite. So I renormalize them. I see what is the multiplicative renormalization which makes correlation functions finite. And once I find the matrix which mixes the operators in such a way that the correlation functions are finite, I should diagonalize that matrix to find the anomalous dimensions and the operators which have good anomalous dimensions. Any question? So let's compute the anomalous dimensions in a particular for particular class of operators in n equals 4 superangles. There's really no question. Is everyone lost or is everyone following? In principle, no. That's a very good question. So when it is not possible to diagonalize H, it can be seen that the conformal field theories get extra terms, which are logarithmics in x minus y instead of just power-like, like I wrote there. And these are called logarithmic conformal field theories. But n equals 4 superangle is not a logarithmic conformal field theory. So they are more exotic class of field theories, which are exactly the ones for which there are the divergences are of this form, indeed, like conformal field theory. It's possible to renormalize the operators by multiplying them by some matrix H, but it's not possible to diagonalize H. And in that case, the result becomes a logarithmic conformal field theory. OK, I can give you some references on that if you want later on. What fixes H is the requirement that, you see, H is fixed in such a way that the operators become renormalized, that the operators give finite correlation functions. So let me write. So H is the following. Let's so that everyone follows. So you have an operator O, B, OK, O, A, renormalized. And this is given by E to the H. Instead of delta 1, now I put a matrix H times log lambda. Now this is a matrix. It has some index AB acting on OB there. So H is the matrix such that OA gives finite correlation functions. Right? So and now correlation functions. This is what it means to renormalize the operator. Correlation functions of OA are finite. And this fixes H. This tells you how to choose H so that this combination gets finite correlation functions. Let's explicitly see this at work in n equals 4 superangles. So let's consider the following class of operators. Let's consider OA to be trace of phi I1, phi I2, etc., phi IL. So each of these indices, I1, I2, etc., runs from 1 to 6, can take values 1 to 6. And we want to consider this subset of operators in n equals 4 superangles. Operators made out only of scalars of the theory. And now, so the first thing we do is let me understand this, let me draw this operator in the double line notation. So there is a trace. So this is the first and last index here I represent by this line. And then each operator is one of this. And here, so this is phi I1, I2, I3, I4. So there is some color, some scalar that I choose. And these lines represent the matrix index of these phi i's, which I didn't write explicitly. So this each guy is a phi I with, it's a matrix with index a, b, which run from 1 to n. Or you can decompose it into generators of sun with some normalization. And now what we do is we want to understand whether this guy with something else here which, and these are some scalars with some indices, J1, J2, J3, up to JL. And these are, if you want, probes. These are, it can be a single trace or it can be whatever. I want to impose that this renormalized operator, when I compute correlation functions with whatever I put here, provided it is also renormalized, it gives a finite result. So I want to see how to renormalize this guy so that I get finite results here. So let's start to do it at one loop. What kind of diagrams contribute at one loop when I compute this two-point function? So one diagram which contributes is, for example, let me think, for example, this one, where I have. This is double line notation. And then all other guys, I do nothing. OK? And here I'm using this vertex, which is commutator of phi I phi j squared. I'm using this vertex here with 1/2 trace of this guy. So there are two possibilities for the color for the indices. Because I'm using this trace of phi I squared, let's write what this trace is. Trace of phi I phi j commutator square. This is equal to trace of phi I phi j phi I phi j with a factor of 2 minus 2 trace of phi I square phi j square. Okay. And okay, there might be some there is a minus 1/2 there. So minus 1/2, then it's probably just minus here and plus. Okay, is this clear? I just expand the commutator and use cyclicity of the trace to write it as these two kind of terms. And now I'm going to use this vertex and to do weak contractions. And because I'm in the double line notation, I cannot cross the lines. As you saw, these lines cannot cross one another. And there are two different possibilities. This guy, phi I, phi j, there are two neighboring phi i's and two neighboring phi j's. So in terms of color of the index I, what this diagram does is something like this. The two neighboring guys are yellow, and then the two neighboring red. Okay, this is the index j, this is the index I. Okay? And this vertex here, at the level of color, what it does is I is exchanged with j. Because there is ij, ij, so they alternate the color. So when I draw this, there are, of course, two possibilities. I can have the yellow line, for example, going here, and the blue and the index here going here. And so you see that in this case, indeed, the indices are exchanged. I did not get something proportional to the identity. The operator at the end is not the same as the operator in the beginning. And I could also have something like, for example, the yellow line going here and then coming back, and the blue line going here. Instead of this, I could also have this. Okay? And I could also have also, for example, these two guys annihilating and these two guys creating. So let's see. So what is this divergence proportional to? So this divergence, if I put here some momenta in this loop, let's put here some momenta Q. Let's say that here there is some momenta P running away. So here there is some momenta Q minus P. And then what is this? What are these graphs? Let's call this first one D1. Let's call this guy here D2 and this guy here D3. What does D1 give? Well, D1 is a divergence. First of all, it's proportional to the following structure. The index I1, okay, not I1, IN must become the index jn plus 1, and the index in plus 1 must become the index jn. The indices must be exchanged. Okay? Then there are two propagators. So each propagator comes with a factor. They are normalized similarly to the gluon. There is a factor gn mu squared over 2, because I normalized in a way that I have the coupling multiplying here outside 1 over g and mu squared. So the propagator has a factor of g and mu squared over 2. So there is a factor g young mu squared over 2, and there are two propagators square. So this is from the propagators. There is a vertex here. And this vertex, what is the factor that it comes? Now, there are four possible ways of putting this, which always gives this index structure. Whatever way I put this vertex, here, 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 or here, I always get the same result. So there is a factor of 4 because this is equal to the rotation by 90 degrees of the same thing, etc. So there are four possible ways of putting this diagram. There is a factor of 4. And the way I wrote it, there is a minus sign, so there is actually a sign minus 4. There is the vertex. The vertex comes with a g young mills square over 2 factor. there is something wrong in what I'm doing. I know, the vertex comes with 1 over g on mu squared, sorry. The vertex comes with 1 over g on mu squared. It multiplies the action in that way. And then there is the momenta integral, the interesting part. And this momenta integral is the integral d4q over 2 pi to the 4, and then 1 over q squared times q minus p squared, the two propagators. There's something which I'm forgetting. Can someone point out what I'm forgetting? It's related to the loop here. It's related to the fact that I have a closed line here. So I'm summing over this matrix index here in this loop. So what do I get? Factor of n, exactly. So there is a factor of n missing here. And this is because of this loop. OK. And now, recall that we only want the coefficient proportional to log lambda. So this measure here, this d4q, is just the usual 2 pi squared q squared dq, q cubed dq, sorry, in 4 dimensions, right? So it's just the element in 4 dimensions. And this here, it's 1 over q to the 4 plus corrections at large q, of course. And now you see that you have qq, and here 1 over q to the 4. So this is a logarithmic divergence. So indeed, I get, so let's hope I got all the factors right. So let's see. So 16, there is, OK, this 16 I will keep. And now there is a 2 times a 4 and a 2 here. So, and the vertex, wait a second, the vertex I forgot a 1/2. From this vertex, so there is a 2 here. So 2 to 2, 4, this 4 kills that 4, and I get a 2 there. So this I get minus 2 times this delta I1n jn plus 1, delta in plus 1 jn. And then I get g young mills square times n over 16 pi square times log lambda. Okay. This is this diagram D1. Yes?
Then
the overall normalization, you can check more carefully, but it's probably. It should be 2 because
the first one half is squared.
Ah, very good. I knew that it was 2 and I was sure. Very good. OK. So this is what I get for this D1. This divergence is not proportional. You see, the operator, it has some index, I1 up to IL. And then the divergence is proportional to its changing to a factor, which basically exchanges the index in and in plus 1, and the final indices are permuted. All other indices are the same, of course, it's implicit. All other guys are the same, so there is this times delta i1 j1, delta i2 j2, etc. Everyone else is just free. But these two are exchanged. So this is one term. The coefficient of this is one term in this Hamiltonian. So let's call this, let's define this quantity as g squared. And I want to make an important comment, of course. We see that the coupling which appears is not g and mu, the coupling of the theory, but g and mu squared times n, which is the proof coupling. You saw that this was the parameter which appears in the expansion. It's not g and mu, but g and mu squared times n. So what about, and finally, let me also represent this as symbolically in this way, which is clear what I mean that I permute the two indices. Yeah. So what is D2 now in this notation? D2 is this one here. And now I only have this guy, I have to use this vertex. And now I cannot rotate 4 times
because I can only use this one, or when I rotate by 180 degrees. I always need the two lines to be like this. So now, instead of this minus 2, I get plus 1 times this diagram times this g squared log 1. The rest is the same. What about the d3? The d3, I have to manipulate. Again, I have to use this vertex. And again, there are two possibilities. The one rotated by 90 degrees or the one rotated by minus 90 degrees. Again, only a factor of 2 and not a factor of 4. So again, plus 1 times this times g squared log 1. Okay? So altogether, so far, what we have is that this d1 plus d2 plus d3 is equal to log lambda, and the coefficient of log lambda is minus 2 g squared. Okay, let me take g squared outside. There is a g squared, and the coefficient is minus 2 times this structure which permutes them, plus this guy which annihilates it, plus this structure which keeps the color index the same. Okay? Any questions here? Now, this here is part of this Hamiltonian H, because I consider the set of graphs, only the graphs using one of the vertices. If I want to see the other graphs, I will get the other contributions of H. Now,
what do you mean by the other contributions of H?
So what I'm seeing is that this diagram, the divergence is proportional to log lambda times this structure. So let's call this here some H, I, N, I, N plus 1, J, N, J, N plus 1. Okay? Then the operator there, some indexes, I1, IL, minus, instead of plus, minus, G squared times H. Okay, times log lambda, times late h, and now here, j1, jn, i1, il, sorry. Times the bare operator, all 0, within j1 up to jl, is finite. Why is that? Because when I compute now correlation functions, I have the operator O0A with some loops here, which give me something proportional to log 1. And let me schematically represent this with plus A. But then my operator is normalized, my operator A is this guy, plus some, or minus, because I put it with minus, A times this guy where these two guys, for example, are exchanged. And now I have the free quick contraction, and this is proportional to log lambda. So this free part is proportional to minus a log lambda. So by defining it in this way, by construction, the divergence here cancels the divergence here. Right? So I just need to understand how it diverges, and then I subtract that to renormalize my operator. Right? Basically, because 1 plus x and 1 minus x is 1. Minus x squared, and the ordering perturbation here is now 1 higher, and therefore we renormalize the operator. Right? So, but this is not the full story. This is part of the Hamiltonian, but there is more, because there are more diagrams. We just draw to the ones with the scalars. But actually, those are the interesting ones, because what other diagrams do we have? Well, let me tell you what other diagrams that one loop could lead to divergence and then do lead to divergence. We have, for example, this one, where I have the scalars I1, IN, IN plus 1, and the exchangeable one. And then I have the ones where I have 2x and I have self-energy of the legs. For example, fermion loop. Now, there's something particular about all these diagrams. All these diagrams the index in goes to the index jn, the index in plus 1 goes to the index jn plus 1. And all these diagrams, they are equal therefore to something, well, lambda, times a coefficient, which I did not compute, because I would have to compute all diagrams, but what I want to emphasize is that it's proportional to delta in jn, delta in plus 1, jn plus 1. Basically, because gluons don't carry color, so when you have processes exchanging gluons or whatever, they cannot change the color of the scale. So the Feynman diagrams are such that this scalar has component 1, here you get component 1. And if here you have component 2, here you get component 2. You cannot exchange it by changing the gluon. And that's very different compared with these scalars, where I could change the color, could change positions. So all these diagrams, with whatever coefficient it is, they modify the Hamiltonian by changing this coefficient here. But they don't touch these two coefficients. Okay? And now, I have to use a tag. I could compute this, but I'm going to do to cheat and to say that trace of the following operator, phi1 plus I phi2 to the power L, this by arguments of symmetry, we know that this has zero anomalous dimensions. So this is... as an exercise, you can compute all these diagrams. I can draw you, if you want, at the very end, compute the coefficient, and check that this coefficient is 2. It turns out that if you do a computation, this coefficient is 2. But you saw already how to do the computation. Just need to draw the diagrams, the log one, the divergence, and you have to do another computation and get 2. But there is a way to guess that it should be 2, it's because I know that this guy has zero anomalous dimension. So the anomalous dimension of this guy is 1. And by fixing this, I can see that this operator, therefore h, should act on this operator, press, to give 0. This action here of this on this operator should be 0. And this fixes this coefficient. Okay? But alternatively, you could do another computation and find that that coefficient there is. So let me summarize what we have found. We have found the following. To summarize, let me introduce some notation. Let me say that, let me look at an operator, trace, of phi I1, phi IL. Let me think of this operator as being a spin chain state, where at each side of my spin chain, I have a polarization. Instead of being just spin up or spin down, I have a number I1, which can be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I have I1, it's just a way of looking at my state. Okay? And then, we said that this Hamiltonian took this form. And in the spin chain language, this means the following. This means that I should consider an Hamiltonian A, which is basically G squared, sum over the sides of the Hamiltonian, 1 up to n, and then there is a term, minus twice the permutation operator acting on side n and then plus 1, plus the trace operator I'm going to define it acting on side n and then plus 1, which is the second there, plus twice the identity operator acting on side n and then plus 1. This is a spin chain Hamiltonian. And what we said is that H, if you consider the action on spin chain states, and if you compute the spectrum of these spin chain states, then the energy is equal, or the spectrum is equal to the spectrum of anomalous dimensions of these operators. And these cats psi are the operators renormalized with the eigenvalues, the eigenvectors of this Schrodinger problem are the renormalized operators with a definite anomalous dimension. And let me be more specific. So what is this permutation? This permutation n and n plus 1, it acts here on some indices a and b at positions n and n plus 1. and it's just permutes them. It's the first one there. Gives B, A, and they are just permutes. The identity operator, which checks on site M and then plus 1, it's the last term, the one in yellow there. It acts on a state which has components A and B at positions M and then plus 1, does nothing. And the trace operator, which is the last diagram there, no, not the last, sorry, the next to last, this one, which annihilates and creates, it acts, so M and then plus 1, it acts on a state AB, and they must be the same, A and B, so there's a delta AB, and when they are the same, it gives all other possible colors. So there's a sum over C for 1 up to 6, blah, 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 C, C. So you see that you have a very simple operator, set of operators. You have a spin chain, this operator, which is a trace of fields. You see it as a spin chain, where you have a spin with polarization I1, I2, etc. to IL. And then you have an Hamiltonian, which acts on this spin chain. And the spectrum of this Hamiltonian, which has this very simple action, this operator, the spectrum of this Hamiltonian are the anomalous dimensions of operators of n equals 4 at 1. This set of operators of n equals 4 at 1. Why is this? Why did I draw this chain as code? Because it's a trace. So because it's a trace, there is of course no order, and I can shift these guys here and put them some on the other side. So it's a closed spin chain. And the spectrum of this closed spin chain is the spectrum of anomalous dimensions of n equals 4 spins. What is special about this? So is there some signs of integrability here? And the answer is no, not yet. So this is a conformal field theory, right? So there ought to be some operator which mixes the operators like this, which I can, of course, look at it as a spin chain. This is just a question of notation. I just decide that instead of having phi I put an I1 and a symbol of a case. That's just a question of notation. So this Hamiltonian looks very much like a spin chain Hamiltonian because it only the spin n and n plus 1, only neighboring spins interact. Is this particular when it was 4? No, okay, no. This is only because of planar limits. The graphs, they do not cross. So I could not draw a loop where I have my operator here. If this was not in a large n limit, I could draw very well this scalar interacting with this one. But then this would cross all these lines, which is forbidden in the planar limit. So this is not allowed in the planar limit when n goes to infinity. So that's why the interactions are local, and the spins only interact when they are neighbors. If it was long-range interactions happen in the non-planar limit. So far, the only thing which was non-trivial about the angle force preamules was that the divergences were indeed logarithmic in lambda, and therefore that they just amount to multiplicative renormalization of the operator. Everything else, there was no sign of integrability. But now, as I will show you in the next lecture, it turns out that this Hamiltonian is integral. And that the fact that the ratio between this coefficient and this coefficient, if this ratio was any different, if this was minus 3 and 1, we would not know how to compute the spectrum. It's because of this miracle of n equals 4 that the coefficients are such that the ratio between the two, this ratio, ensures that the model is integrable, that it is an exactly solvable Hamiltonian, and that for which you can exactly compute the spectrum of this. And this is not obvious at the moment, but there are some Hamiltonians which are special, which are integrable, for which there exists a huge number of conserved charges, and therefore we can do solve them completely and compute their spectrum. So I have 5 minutes. Let me just compute some examples of anomalous dimensions using now this language. For example, let's consider the operator that I mentioned, the simplest one, this trace of phi I is the so-called, this is the famous, the most famous operator in N+4, it's called the Konishi operator. And let's act. So this is, of course, sum over I of the cat II. And now let's act with the Hamiltonian on this state. So what do we get? So when we have, so we get, when we have the identity does nothing, right? But the permutation does nothing either because the spins are the same, I and I. So when I act on these guys with the identity minus the permutation, I get zero. Because doing the identity or doing the permutation, I get none. So I can ignore the identity and the permutation because they come with equal coefficients. And now I can consider only this one, the trace. When the one acts on II, it kills them and replaces them again by a sum from I equal 1 up to 6. And it does this for each of these guys from 1 up to 6. And therefore, so I have my two spins. And the Hamiltonian can act here, or it can act here. It's a cyclic Hamiltonian, so I have this Hamiltonian 1, 2, and Hamiltonian 2, 1. And therefore, I get a factor of 2 because of acting on this pair or on this pair, which turns out to be the same. And then, whenever I act on this guy, I get a factor of 6 times the state itself. Because whenever I act on 1, 1, I get Konishi again. When I act on 2, 2, I get Konishi again. And there is 6 terms. So 2 times 6 times g squared times the state again. So it means that when I compute correlation functions, the trace of phi I, it means, let's convert into the original language, that I should define an operator which is lambda to the minus 12 g squared times trace of phi 1. And this is, if you want, Konishi renormalized. And then I have Konishi at x, Konishi at y. And this is 1 over absolute value of x minus y to the power 2. And then there is 2, which is the free term, plus 12 g squared plus. That's
it. We just check this one.
And this, the LG square, is the first quantum correct. It's the anomalous dimension of Konishi. Okay? This is the simplest example. Here I don't need integrability. Okay, it's just two sides of the spin chain. Let's do another example. So for example, you can show that the other one, which I represented, which was symmetric and traceless, it has zero anomalous dimension. You can act and check. Because basically it's traceless and it's symmetric. I can even do it immediately. It's symmetric, so again, by the same reason, identity and permutation cancel out with nothing. And it's traceless, so by construction, the trace gives it. So the anomalous dimension of the other guy is zero. Okay? But let's consider now a very important family of operators, which is the following. Let's consider two complex scalars, z, which is phi 1 plus I phi 2, which we call spin up, and x, which is phi 1, phi 3, plus I phi 4, which we call spin down. And let's consider now spin chains of this point, where I have only spin ups and spin downs. Now this turned out to be the usual SU2 spin chain instead of this generalized SO6 spin chain. So let's see why. Now the Hamiltonian, the trace always gives zero. Why does it always give zero? Because the trace, when I act on someone, phi 1 plus I phi 2 on one side, and on the other side, phi 3 plus I phi 4, and then I expand the bracket, of course I get 0, because 1 is never equal to 3 or to 4, and 2 is never equal to 3 or to 4. So here, of course, I get 0. But the non-trivial one is when I act on k on a state which is 1 plus I2, and then, tensor, 1 plus I2 again. This is not so obvious, but it's again 0, because for it to be non-zero, you need 1 to be multiplied by 1, or 2 to be multiplied by 2. 1 times 1 gives Konishi when I act. I destroy one line and I create everything. 2 times 2, you get again the same. You just cancel, you get one from here, and then you get again all possibilities. But because of the I, 2 times 2 comes with a minus sign. So again, this K acting on this guy also gives you. So it means that the Hamiltonian, in this sector, which is called the SU2 sector, that you just made out of this up and down, is just 2 G squared, sum from n equal 1 up to L of the identity n plus 1 minus the permutation n plus 1. I can't forget about the trace. And this is the usual Heisenberg's Hamiltonian. This is the usual Heisenberg spin check. Let's compute with this Hamiltonian again. Yes?
Can you compute the notation with the Mitsubishi? Is that trace of I's in phi I phi j or phi I phi I or just trace of phi I?
This?
Yeah.
It's trace of phi I squared. Phi I? Here?
No, down, down. Yeah.
Here? Ah, sorry. That's a little bit. Right, right.
The trace is not?
Yes, because it's SUN. So as Eric says, if the trace of phi I is 0, because it's SUN, the elements are traces. Okay, very good. So
let me then compute, for example, like I computed Konishi. Can I erase Konishi? Yeah? Okay. Too late. And let me compute, for example, the state. I will make a choice which I know is an eigenvector. Otherwise, I will have to diagonalize. But let me compute the state which corresponds. Let's compute 2 states. Trace of commutator and z with x squared, and trace of the anti-commutator of z with x squared. So this is just related to the state up, down, down, up, minus, up, up, down, down. And this is related to the same with a plus sign. Okay? And if you now act with this guy, can I do it here? Let's see. Probably not. Maybe yes. Okay, I will not, but I will tell the result. Let's call this one cat psi 1 and this cat psi 2. It's an easy exercise to see that the Hamiltonian acting on cat psi 1 is 12 g squared times psi 1, and the Hamiltonian acting on cat psi 2 is 0 times psi 2. 12 g squared, exactly the same that we found for Konishi. Is there a reason? Yes, because it turns out that this guy is related by supersymmetry to this Konishi. If you start applying this symmetry transformation, these finite symmetries that I told you that transform some scalars into some fermions and then some fermions again into some scalars, you can see that these two guys are actually related by supersymmetry. You can start with phi I square and rotate into this commutator of z with x square. So this is also another guy in the same supersymmetry multiplet as Konishi. So this is also Konishi. Of course, the one which I should have started by recalling is that the Hamiltonian acting on only spin up is equal to 0, because identity and permutation give the same. And this was the state what I used to fix the coefficient of the Hamiltonian, was that the Hamiltonian acting on only phi 1 plus I phi 2 to the L, which was just up, 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 was 0. So indeed, of course, I did no mistake, this guy is 0. Identity and permutation give the same. This one also gives 0. Is it easy to understand? Yes, because imagine you act on this guy with the lowering operator S minus, the total spin S minus. What does it do? It flips one of these guys to be minus in one of the 4 possible positions. Now act again with S minus on it. Then you have 2 guys which are flipped to be minus in all possible positions with the same weights. But that's precisely this. But the Hamiltonian has SU2 symmetry, so it commutes with S minus. So of course, the energy of a state which is obtained by acting with S minus on the vacuum is the same as the energy of the vacuum. So it should indeed be 0. Right? So this state here, psi 2, is just S minus the total spin square acting on the vacuum. So of course, it has the same energy of the vacuum because the Hamiltonian is SU2 symmetric. Okay, so I think I'll end here. So what comments do I have here? Let me just make one trivial comment, so which also does not use integrability. What do you expect if I go to two loops instead of one loop? Yes, what kind of things do you expect me to get? Here I got a spin chain Hamiltonian. What happens if I go to two loops instead of one loop? If I will do what I've said now and two loops. Exactly. So what happens now is that when I go to two loops, now I can have something where I have, for example, these two scalars can be exchanged, and then the scalar can exchange a gluon here. And this is allowed. And now the range of the interaction is two instead of one. So what happens when I increase my order in perturbation theory is that the Hamiltonian which I have to diagonalize becomes of longer and longer range. So I get an Hamiltonian which has nearest neighbors interaction, next to nearest neighbors, etc. And it turns out that all of those Hamiltonians with longer and longer range, as I will explain, are integrable. So in one of the exercises that you have, but I think you are only going to do it tomorrow, you are going to explore this particular Hamiltonian, diagonalizing it and understanding its spectrum. And tomorrow I will do it also, but using a different language, a more algebraic language than the one which is proposed in the exercise. So I recommend, if you have time, to give a look at the tutorial, at the first tutorial, which is on the website. Okay, thank you. Sorry?